so I'm helping them with that, and those kind, just all sorts of projects. I put out recordings myself of different musicians. Did the Thompsons recording, you know? But getting, so you visited these musicians and you try to get an entree with them to begin with, and then
after a while I wasted a lot of time trying to meet them, run into them, and it got to be better if I could make an appointment ahead of time. It worked better.
And this would be the years 1953 and 54?
Starting 53 and 4, roughly, yeah. End of 54. Starting, I'd say, the summer of 53, and into that fall, and then a break until the spring of 54, and then at about the end of that summer.
Were you working during the week?
Yeah, I was teaching.
At
that time I would have been at Bethany College.
And so on the weekends, two or three weekends out of the month, you would go looking for fiddlers?
Try to make contact with them during the week, make sure I could get there.
Let's see. All right, let me ask you some questions that Jerry Milnes was interested in. In your dissertation, you said that there was one woman fiddler who would not perform for you. Do you recall if her name was Sarah Singleton or Angie Carpenter?
It might have been Carpenter, because I remember that name came up quite a bit.
She
was bashful, just felt she wasn't good enough.
You remember any of the circumstances where she lived, or?
Well, you mean what town?
Or how you ran into her?
I ran into her because one of these fellows told me about her, and on one of my trips, I happened to be where she was in the same group, but she wouldn't fiddle. I think she was very reluctant because these guys were older and more aggressive. You know how women...
How old was she?
At that time, I judge she's maybe in her 40s.
I see.
She wasn't very old, really. But they were, some of them weren't old either. Bailey was the youngest, I think. He was about 39, that I remember. And then they ranged up to the 60s and 70s, except for Cougar.
Do you remember anyone mentioning some of the, you know, the name Solly Carpenter came up. How about the name Jack McElwain?
Don't remember that name.
Don't remember that? He's a person who's associated, I think, with that tune, Old Sledge.
Well, I know the tune. I mean, I heard the tune many times, but I don't associate him with it.
He would have been, you know, I think he would have passed on probably in the 40s, 30s or 40s, and he was old then.
Yeah.
Now, how about this fellow, the stories about Saul Carpenter?
Well, they were tales, and a lot of the people knew about him and his fiddling and his tunes, and the one that he told about the man who was hanged, who would give his fiddle to him if he could play that tune. He played the tune, the guy gave him his fiddle, and he played it back, so he got his fiddle before he was hanged. That was one of those stories. The other was about Solly's Rock, where he lived when his house was burned. The family lived under this rock. I went up to that place. I didn't think it was much shelter. It was an overhang, maybe.
You went up
four,
to it?
4 or 5 feet, yeah.
Did somebody take you up there?
Or? Yeah, one of the fellows lived near there.
And do you remember who were the fiddlers who talked about Saul Carpenter?
I think probably I could remember some of those if I saw my dissertation and brought back some memories.
You want
you have
the list of Here are the list of notated examples. Is that what you're looking for?
No. looking for the local origin section.
Did you record any of those stories about Uncle or Old Man Solly Carpenter being living under the rock, or?
They're on tapes. They may be on some of these tapes. That one of these tapes, I think Pat let me copy. Maybe it was on that one too.
On that one. You also recorded a Camp Chase.
Camp Chase, yeah. Now that was Arden Wilson, I think, was the one talking about that.
Or Emory Bailey.
Bailey, that's right, because it was a Ohio prison.
Right.
That's right. Now it comes back to me.
He says that Jerry Milne said that he has interviewed Saul Carpenter's great-granddaughter, who remembered names of the other fiddlers that were in the Camp Chase contest. Was there anyone who, did Emory Bailey give you any descriptions about that contest or any other facts about it?
Well, I don't remember it was a contest. As I recall the story, it was, they were in this prison and they played the tunes after they came out of the prison. But I don't remember any contest. Do I mention contest in the...
The one who played the best tune would win their freedom.
Yeah, that was the story, though, that Emory told me.
Right.
That wasn't a contest. Is that what you call a contest? Okay.
Yeah, where they were... Whoever played the best tune they would let him out of the prison camp.
Here it is, right here, near Columbus, Ohio. While in prison, the guards decided they would release the fiddler who could play and compose and play the best tune. Solly played and composed, and since the tune and the fiddling were superior, he was released. There it is on page 26. Yeah. Gee, I should read this thing over again, shouldn't I? You know how it is when you get involved in career and...
Oh, yeah.
Your life goes off in other directions. Have you ever heard this Camp Chase?
Yeah. That was it from Emory Bailey?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very nice. His old sledge is very nice, too.
Yeah, and he used the old tuning. The G string was raised to A, so they had A-E-A-E to play. A lot of them did that.
Was that the first time you'd run into that, was in West Virginia?
Yeah, yeah.
And then they had a tuning called the Discord tuning they used for the old sledge.
Yeah. That was to get that interval in there, as I recall.
Right. In the dissertation, you talk about them, the old fiddlers using the term bass, counter, triplum, and fine for the strings.
Yeah.
Who used those terms, Dr. Hartley?
Do I talk about it in here?
Yeah, but it doesn't say who did it.
If I could find it in here, it would probably be bring back my memory. Arden Wilson, I think, was one that told me
look,
about him.
Look on page 73.
G-D-A-E, first, second, third, fourth strings, lowest fixed string is called the bass, next is called the counter, and third is called the triplum. Oh, yeah, I remember that.
You remember who told you about that?
Uh, was, I can't be sure, but I think Emery Bailey was one of them who talked about it. I'd have to go back again to find my cards. I can answer a lot of your questions.
Let's see.
Well, obviously, I must have. I didn't make a notice to who told it on that, did I?
No, I didn't. I don't think so. Not in the dissertation.
Yeah, as I look at this thing, if I were to rewrite this, go back to my notes, I would probably change some things. Do a better job than I did.
Well, it's very interesting. Do you, you know, you have two tunes in there. I don't know if you recall. One is Solly's Little Favorite.
Old Favorite, he called it.
Well, then there's Old Solly's Favorite and Solly's Little
Favorite. Favorite, yeah.
Now, Emery Bailey paid Solly's Little Favorite.
And it was different than the other one.
Yeah, but where did you get the other one? Was that from Pat Gaynor?
That could have been from Pat, or it could have been from one of those other fiddlers that was in that same area. I went back to some of those places, not the same people, but to different people in the same area. And it was funny how I got the same tune, but entirely different rendition and different title to it. Maybe 20 miles apart. Or less.
Well, it looks like, and on those tapes, if we run across one called Old Solly's Favorite, the only way we'd know is by these notes. Note cards probably have them on there.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, that's an important thing. That when you find those, give me a call.
Yeah, I've looked over and I have a suspicion. That may have been, I had a cabinet right there in front of that window, a record cabinet, and I kept a lot of that stuff in there. And when I went to the hospital, or was coming home from the hospital, she had to take everything out of here and put it out there in the shed, what we call the shop. And that place, I can't even get in now, it's just jammed with stuff. And that cabinet's out there under a bunch of stuff. And I'm not able to do the lifting and moving. I have to wait till my sons can help me.
Yeah.
But I have a suspicion that's where they might be, because I looked all through those shelves, and I found the dissertation copy and the record, and these tapes were back in my study.
And you think that's all of the tapes?
I'm pretty sure that is. But some reason I'm missing another record like that.
Are you talking about the record the Library of Congress put out?
Yeah.
Using some of your material?
Yeah, they used about four tunes, as I recall. It was a collection of American fiddlers. Mm-hmm. Don't you remember when that came out?
No.
Do you have a copy of it?
I don't have a copy of the one that has Emery Bailey on it.
Well, they only came out with one, didn't they?
No, they came out with another one that has...
On fiddlers?
Yeah.
I didn't know they came out with another.
Well, maybe the one I'm thinking about... the one I'm thinking about Alan Jabbour did.
Yeah, what year was that?
About...
70s?
About 69 or 70 or something like that.
I have a thing that Alan sent me... He had come to the house many, many years ago in the 60s, 64, I think. And I'd given him a copy of all this stuff. And then he wrote me a letter and he put some other tunes that he had run across, thought I might be interested in. He notated.
Oh.
That's in that. Hmm. I found it today.
The main thing we're missing is a set of note cards that all the names of the musicians were.
Well, stories about them too.
And stories about
them.
Not
just the names. But. No, I don't. I was telling him. I think I had that stuff in that credenza that had the record cabinet was here, that's out in the shop. And I just wondered if maybe that wasn't, when they moved that out for that hospital bed, maybe it wasn't. Do you remember taking anything out of that, or did he just take it all?
I do remember that all that stuff was in there.
Yeah. It was? Yeah. Do you want me to go look, or?
No way. No way.
Is it like?
Well, it's buried, literally. It's
really?
Got,
I might be able to claw through all the stuff to get to. I mean, it's at the far end of the storage.
See, that was, we're talking about 3 years ago when they moved all this stuff out of here. And everything has been dumped on top of it since then.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've got that same situation now. Well, I'll be happy to help if you'd like. Or
well, the only thing is that I know what it looks like. Nobody else does.
I think I do too. It's a stack of cards and it's got an ancient rubber band around it.
Right.
I mean, I remember seeing it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Years.
Well, I bet that's where it is.
Let me go see if I can crawl through. Well, I also know where the credenza is.
Well, that's more than I know.
Small.
Well, you need some help?
You want.
I've got a weasel. Okay.
No, it's really, the situation is bad out there. I got file cabinets, probably 7 or 8 file cabinets filled with stuff. The floor is jammed with boxes of music. It's just, I almost hate to walk in the place.
Let me ask you this.
When the tape recorder is off, I want to tell him the story of the piano.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Again, this is from Jerry Mills. And he says, Jerry says, I hold that the difference in the music and repertoire between Samuel Bayard's Hill Country tunes and the repertoire of Central West Virginia would be the black influence on Central West Virginia music. Both areas, southwestern Pennsylvania and Central West Virginia, have similar Scots-Irish, German ethnic influence, but the Pennsylvania area did not have any or much early black influence. West Virginia, however, imported many thousands of blacks to south-central West Virginia as early as 1800 to work in the salt mines. Any thoughts or comments about black influence on central West Virginia fiddling?
That's interesting. I honestly can't say I have any idea or heard anything relative to that. Everything I heard always went back to the same source. They were Irish tunes. They never mentioned anything about blacks. I never ran into any blacks.
Never, or heard of anybody talk about black
musicians?
No, musician.
I never heard that discussed at all. And I just think these came straight from Europe to the mountains and grew there and spread. And if the influence is there, it was never mentioned. That's an interesting statement. I can understand about the importation of workers, but I can't connect it to the music. He's thinking they reflected in the music.
Yes, yeah. He goes on to ask, did you encounter black musicians from the Granny's Creek, Benny's Run, or Long Run areas of Braxton County? Unlike the salt mine slaves, these communities originated from farm labor slave holdings, and they had come to Braxton County from early white settlers, and my research shows that they produced a fair amount of folk music. And he's identified 3 influential black fiddlers in that area who lived
at that same time?
No, that lived in the 1800s.
Oh.
I imagine 1800s and early 1900s.
After the Civil War, probably.
Yeah, it doesn't say when, but I assume that's the case.
That's interesting.
But you know, the banjo, of course, is an African American instrument.
You know Joe Thompson?
Yeah.
Well, Joe, he just got back from Australia, his most recent trip, and he comes in the shop all the time to have me work on his instrument, and I listen to that guy play, and I can't discern much difference in the tunes that I recognize that he plays and what I've heard in West Virginia. That's the thing. And I'm wondering where this exemplifies.
Well, there is one interesting thing that you noted. I forgot how you call what you call it. It's a note that's an in-between note.
I had to make little signs to show how to get the pitch.
Yeah, and they, on some of the real old pieces, I think some of your fiddlers did it.
Yeah, everything's out of it.
It is?
And it's in pieces. It's
what's in pieces?
It's come unglued.
The cabinet? Oh my God.
But the Joe uses a flatted third a lot in his playing.
Then I put a section in here on pitch.
I think you did, yeah.
I remember.
But I think you were talking about them flatting the fourth and seventh notes.
Yes.
Joe flat, his flatted notes are thirds and sevenths.
Now here, Noxious on the Hill, I indicated some changes of pitch, particularly on the second finger, on all the strings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, another thing that comes to my mind looking at these, that Noxious on the Hill and Noxious Under the Hill.
Uh-huh. Are they the same piece?
No, that's what... Let's see if I can find that. Noxious on the Hill. Here's Noxious on the Hill and here's Under the Hill. Everything's different. Rhythm, syncopation, everything in this, in this.
I forgot what your Natchez on the Hill was from Emory Bailey, but I can't remember where your Natchez Under the Hill comes from.
Printed collection of Ford. This is the one that I got in the Newbury Library.
I see. Where is your original thesis now? Is it at
Roosevelt University?
Where?
Chicago Music College of Roosevelt University. It's like the music department of Carolina.
Uh-huh.
They call it Chicago Musical College, a separate school in the university. See, it used to be an independent private school when I went to it, but like everything else that came along. Here's some more of this Wild Horse. Did the same thing.
They have the flatted note.
A little gliss, yeah. Yeah, I guess I should someday just make myself sit down and reread this thing.
Well, I think it's helped a lot of people out, reading it and comparing what they've done with what you did.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I'm sure has changed. They're probably more sophisticated in the research today than I was, because I was striking out in the dark without anything to go on. And I probably would have changed a lot of things if I'd done it over or at this period. But I would have also lost a lot.
You mean if you'd started now? Yeah, you wouldn't.
I wouldn't have had the same opportunity.
No, none of these people would be around.
But what I'm thinking about is I would have approached it differently because there was better equipment and better background to start with. See, Sam Bayard was the first person I had known who had done any live work. And then I came along, and those who came after us had something to build on, a base. And they had a procedure they could build on, too.
What do you think was the most important part of your research?
From what aspect?
I was thinking of...
Musical?
Yeah.
Well, doing this before, while it was still in its, what I call, infant stage, before they had influences come in that changed it, as I call it, corrupted it. And that's the one thing that was the motivation for me to do it in the first place. And then the history, it was interesting how these things came about and how these people lived. And these fiddlers went from town to town and served as music for dances, funerals, weddings. Then in the winter they sit in front of these stoves and help kids learn how to carve instruments and make them and teach them the tunes. I mean, they were the source of history, information, gossip, rumor. They were a traveling circus man. Huh? Yes, exactly. American French troubadour.
Did you ever go to any of the dances?
I don't recall that I had, not in this particular time. I'd been to some of these dances, but they weren't what I was doing this study.
Well, I think we've done it about as much as we can do now. Maybe if we can find the cards, we can follow up on it. And
yeah, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was tempted today to call you and say I can't find the cards. There's no point in coming. But
well, no, we've gotten a lot of good information.
At least you.
Yeah.
Got a little history.
And let me mention that what I would like to do would be to take the tapes to the Southern Folklife Collection at University of North Carolina, have them send you a release form, and y'all, you know, whether that you can have this material available for research if you want it to be, or it can be held there and preserved.
Well, these tapes are going to deteriorate.
Yeah,
I mean they're not going. They're 40 years old now.
I know. They need to be preserved. They need to make. They'll probably make a new master. You know, copy them onto a state-of-the-art equipment.
Yeah, but you looked upset. But you don't want him to leave, is that it?
Well, I think you ought to. I would think about it real hard.
Well, what am I going to do with it?
They could always be. You can always get to them if you want to.
I'm thinking of him. He has a son who's really, really interested in them. And I think maybe they're going to have them.
Of the originals?
But maybe a master copy.
Oh, yeah. That would be.
Shape.
Yeah. What I'm afraid is going to happen. Yeah, they are.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, what about this? Could we make a deal? Would they, if they want these things, what they want to use out of them, would they make a copy for us to,
oh, yeah,
to preserve that I could pass on to my
absolutely
children?
Yes.
A copy of that and a copy of
this. Oh, yeah, sure, sure. Oh, sure. No, they would make you a copy. They probably make, on whatever format you wanted, DAT, cassette, reel-to-reel. They can't make a CD yet, but...
I would probably think, what, cassette, huh? That'd be simplest.
I think you should do something, though, because they'll disintegrate, and
I
then
know.
They'll be gone.
Yeah, these...
It's sort of like the cards that we can't...
Right.
These things are made on filament, you know.
All right.
Some of them. What is it, Scotch brand? These older ones. This is plastic. I guess these older tapes here are, I mean, the newer tapes are made of, no, they're still vinyl, they're still the same thing.
Yeah.
They're all gonna die. You take and use what you want, And I'll sign a release with the agreement that they'll make a copy of what they want to keep to send back to us so we can, so my kids can look at it.
Oh, and they can, the other thing is if they ever want to go over there and get to them and see them, they can always do that too. Have y'all been up there?
No.
It is a beautiful, they have a beautiful facility. It's on
where
the top,
are they? Where is
it's
it
the top floor of Wilson Library.
Oh, in the library.
In the Southern Historical Collection. It's really very, very nice. And
can any North Carolinian?
You could go. Mm-hmm. If you tell them, once you donate this material, who you are, I mean, I'm sure you can go back and go into the stacks. They also have really nice listening rooms.
And you said they had good equipment for preserving.
Yeah, they have state-of-the-art equipment for preserving this. They've got, in fact, the last 3 years, all they've been doing is restoring at-risk recordings.
Better than the Library of Congress, no doubt.
I think they may be at this point.
Yeah.
It is, and it will have your name on it and be there for future.
Well, you know, for long years, when I was in the state in the 60s, particularly in the 70s, I'd get letters from universities around the country wanting a copy, and I just never had the time to sit down and make a copy. So I told them to write to Roosevelt, and I guess they did because they secured copies. In fact, I think this Titan, is that his name?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Got a copy from them. And I don't know about Millen, did he?
He doesn't know.
Did he get one?
He doesn't. He wanted one, and I was going to make him one of what I've got that you made for me. Where did you get the one you made for me?
What? That?
You made one for me, or you gave me something that I copied. I don't know what it's from. It seemed like it was from a cassette. Maybe Alan Jabour made for you.
No. I don't remember that, Alan.